loaded. The server crashed. Lehigh agreed to host the blog post on the university site, and John started taking his laptop to class, not hearing a word the professor said as he watched the page views stack up in real time. But the real craziness began in November when a man in Longmont, Colorado, identifying himself only as John D., started a petition on the White House website, We the People. John D. demanded that the U.S. government secure funding and resources and begin construction on a Death Star by 2016 as a job creation measure. Nobody knows for sure if John D. was inspired by Centiv's post, but every news story on the petition made mention of Sean's estimate. Centiv's actively promoted the petition, and in just 2 weeks, it had secured the 25,000 signatures then required for a White House response. In January, the White House responded. It wasn't required to do so in a timely fashion under the rules of We the People. Washington was deadlocked over the budget and debt negotiations known as the fiscal cliff. This clearly frivolous petition could have been filed away in the virtual equivalent of a desk drawer for years. But President Obama, who had played with toy lightsabers on the White House lawn with the U.S. Olympic fencing team, and who had once been described as a Jedi Knight by George Lucas himself, couldn't resist. Paul Shawcross, at the Office of Management and Budget, was directed to draft a response. NASA was consulted. The result would shoehorn in just about every Star Wars reference known to a mainstream audience. Titled, This Isn't the Petition Response You're Looking For, the response asked, Why would we spend countless taxpayer dollars on a Death Star with a fundamental flaw that can be exploited by a one-man starship? Shawcross pointed out that a human-made fortress called the ISS already orbited Earth. That's no moon. It's a space station, and a laser-wielding robot was currently roaming Mars. He compared science and technology education to the Force, just so he could quote Darth Vader, Remember, the Death Star's power to destroy a planet or even a whole star system is insignificant next to the power of the Force. But for Sean and Anjan, the most important part of the letter came right at the beginning. The construction of the Death Star has been estimated to cost more than $850 quadrillion, Shawcross wrote, with a link back to the Lehigh page. We're working hard to reduce the deficit, not expand it. Later, Lucasfilm sent a tongue-in-cheek response from Galactic Empire Public Relations. The costs of construction, they cited, were ridiculously overestimated, though I suppose we must keep in mind that this minuscule planet does not have our massive means of production, said Admiral Mahdi of the Imperial Starfleet. The two bloggers were, so to speak, over the moon. We wanted to see what the president had to say, says Anjan, but we never expected to be referenced. It was an historic moment, to be sure. One student's idle thought while watching a Star Wars movie had gone all the way to the White House in the space of a year. And all it took was a Death Star reference, a little math, and a finely tuned sense of buffoonery. An alien observer watching the hubbub surrounding the Death Star petition might well have surmised that our planet had lost its mind. Millions of us, including the leader of the free world, were caught up in what appeared to be an earnest discussion over building a ridiculously impossible thing, a giant planet-destroying orbital laser a tenth the size of our moon. The alien observer would probably be justified in vaporizing us for such talk. It would be easy to miss the humor beneath the deadpan tone of the whole affair. It wasn't satirical. There was no target. Star Wars itself was not being mocked. The goal for the people who participated was to stay in character, as if they really were endeavoring to bring the ultimate weapon of Star Wars into our galaxy, here and now. The humor of the whole episode was predicated on people knowing and caring intently about details, some of them extremely minute, from the films and their attendant media. The comments section on the Marginal Revolution blog post about the Death Star calculation is a case in point. Here, even now, sober economists hash out questions about the variables. Whether to factor in the slave labor of Wookiees, which was partly responsible for its construction, according to the novel Death Star, or whether you could fund the whole thing from taxes on the population of Coruscant, which is said to have a trillion inhabitants, thus funding the Death Star at a cost of roughly $8,000 per person, or whether a quality assurance engineer should have nixed a thermal exhaust port 2 meters wide that led directly to the main reactor shaft, and what effect this oversight might have had on the Empire's chances of getting an insurance policy on its second Death Star. What's particularly odd is that these sorts of conversations have been going on for years and show no signs of slowing down. Perhaps the best-known Death Star riff is captured in Clerks, the 1994 no-budget movie that made director Kevin Smith famous. One of the titular store clerks and his friend discuss the independent contractors who must have been aboard the second under-construction Death Star when the Rebel Alliance blew it up. Wouldn't they have been innocent victims? A roofing contractor, who happens to be listening in, assures the clerks that, no, in his experience, contractors have to make political decisions. For instance, whether to work for Jersey mobsters. Those people on the Death Star knew what they were getting into. The clerks' contractors' conversation prompted an equally goofy response some years later from George Lucas. In Episode 2, Lucas included a scene in which we see the Geonosians, an insect race, handing over a hologram of what would become DS-1. They would be the ones that were probably contracted to build the Death Star, Lucas said on the movie's DVD commentary track, casually contradicting the story of slave Wookiees. The clerks' characters, Lucas acknowledged, were worried that they got killed on the Death Star, but they are, after all, just a bunch of large termites. There's something about Star Wars that makes this kind of geeky rumination acceptable to a mainstream audience. You can't imagine a roofing contractor saying the same thing about a Borg cube from Star Trek. Even when the aim is to be utterly silly, an earnestness emerges. This pattern was in evidence right from the start in the very first Star Wars parody, Hardware Wars. The writer-director of Hardware Wars, Ernie Fesselius, saw Star Wars the week it came out in 1977, and says he was already plotting the parody while he was in the theater. Hardware Wars was shot in 4 days by a bunch of broke 20-somethings, the Shawns and Anjans of their day. In less-than-glamorous locations around San Francisco, the backs of bars, garages, and an abandoned French laundry. The costume designer provided the $8,000 budget. Fesselius and filmmaker Michael Wiese came up with the tagline, "You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll kiss $3 goodbye." Hardware Wars was a 12-minute version of Star Wars in the form of a trailer. On the surface, you might think it a zany, low-budget parody and nothing more. The characters have names like Fluke Starbucker, Darth Nader, Augie Ben Doggy of the Red Eye Knights, Princess Android with her cinnamon buns strapped on, Ham Salad, and Chuchilla the Wookiee Monster, a brown, furry Cookie Monster puppet. But there's a distinct sense of affection about Hardware Wars. The filmmakers are really trying, gosh darn it, to make a steam iron stand in for a Star Destroyer as it chases after a rebel toaster, or to replicate the destruction of Alderaan with an exploding basketball. Fesselius and Wiese hired veteran voice actor Paul Frees to narrate the whole trailer. And when they said hired, it turned out they meant agreed to do maintenance work for. His voice is so rich, you actually think you are seeing incredible space battles, Wiese says, when in fact, it's only a 4th of July sparkler. Most of all, there was the assumption that everyone watching would be inherently familiar with the subject matter. It was a safe bet. This was San Francisco, after all. The first all-Star Wars city, the creator's town, his first step in the conquest of the universe. The bet paid off. Hardware Wars grossed $500,000 in a year. That was a 6,250% return on investment, making it one of the most successful short films of all time. Lucas wasn't about to launch a lawsuit. He called Hardware Wars a cute little film, and later declared it to be his favorite fan tribute. Wiese, flush with success, won a meeting with Alan Ladd Jr. and three lawyers with expensive suits at Fox. They watched the short, Wiese said, without so much as a giggle. "Well, kid," said Laddie, "what do you want us to do?" Wiese had no hesitation. "I want you to show this with Star Wars. You know, Make fun of your own movie. I'll get back to you, Laddie said. And I'm sure he will, Weesey said, decades later. The closest Lucasfilm ever got to getting litigious over a parody came in 1980. Mad Magazine had mined Star Wars for material, exactly as Lucas had predicted. Now artist Mort Drucker and writer Dick DiBartolo had produced their send-up of the sequel, The Empire Strikes Out. Perhaps because there had been such a culture of secrecy around certain revelations in the plot of the original film, Lucasfilm's legal department sent a cease and desist letter demanding that Mad turn over all profits made from the issue. Mad just smiled and sent back a copy of a letter from Mad's number one fan, some guy named George W. Lucas. Special Oscars should be awarded to Drucker and DiBartolo, the George Bernard Shaw and Leonardo da Vinci of comic satire, Lucas had written. Their sequel to my sequel was sheer galactic madness. He couldn't resist pointing out a gaping inconsistency in the parody. Han Solo appears in the Millennium Falcon several panels after he has been frozen in carbonite. Does this mean I can skip episode 6? Lucas wrote, which was probably more of a cry for help than the magazine realized. Keep up the good farce. Lucasfilm's legal department never wrote Mad again. One of its members, Howard Rothman, told the magazine many years later the incident happened because no one in the legal office, then based in L.A., had talked to anyone in San Anselmo about it. Charlie Lippincott, meanwhile, had been actively sending Mad some Star Wars gags of his own. I wrote them and said, I didn't think they went far enough, Lippincott said. He chuckled at the legal department's temerity. You can't sue Mad Magazine. Like Star Wars itself, the parodies seemed to pretty much die out after the original trilogy ended in 1983. The one notable exception, Mel Brooks's feature-length Spaceballs in 1987, seemed outdated on arrival. It should have been made several years ago, before our appetite for Star Wars satires had been completely exhausted, wrote Roger Ebert. This movie already has been made over the last 10 years by countless other satirists. A handful of the jokes, such as the princess's hair buns turning out to be ear warmers, arrived direct from Hardware Wars. But again, like Star Wars, the spoofs came roaring back in 1997, bigger and better than ever. That was the year a character designer at the Fox Kids Network named Kevin Rubio unveiled a film at San Diego Comic-Con called Troops. It was Star Wars meets Cops, the ride-along reality show known for its theme tune, Bad Boys, which Rubio also used. Cops, not Star Wars, was the parody target of Troops. Witness the stormtrooper with the Minnesota accent who likes the small-town feel of Tatooine and resolves domestic disputes with the world-weary diplomacy of local lawmen everywhere. Instead of being a send-up of Star Wars, Troops affectionately imitates the films as closely as possible. We get stormtroopers on speeder bikes and brief shots of Imperial ships landing that wouldn't look out of place in the original trilogy. The CGI era had dawned, and far more was possible on a tight budget than in the Hardware Wars days. If anything, Troops gets more immersive as it moves along. The 10-minute short turns out to be an elaborate alternate explanation for what happened to Luke Skywalker's Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru. Without the cops layer, it would be an earnest fan film, which, in some senses, it still is. I couldn't do a serious piece, lamented Rubio. For want of budget, he meant, not for want of trying. The only person who can do a serious piece is George. Troops was an instant sensation and inspired hundreds of other filmmakers. In 2010, it topped a Time list of the top 10 Star Wars fan films. Lucasfilm decided to embrace the genre and established the official Star Wars Fan Film Awards. Troops won the Pioneer Award. Other categories included Best Comedy, Best Mockumentary, and Best Parody of a Commercial. Even the winners of the ultimate trophy, the George Lucas Selects Award, tend to be on the spoof side. As Lucas embraced the parodies embraced back. George Lucas in Love was a 1999 short by Joe Nussbaum, a recent USC graduate, and his fellow grads. Once again, The comedic target was something other than Star Wars, the recent Oscar winner Shakespeare in Love, and the way it imagined the playwright's inspirations to be constantly in front of his face. Set at USC in 1967 and filmed on the campus, it showed Lucas struggling to write an agricultural fantasy called Space Oats, while a stream of influences surround him unheeded. A dorm room rival breathing like Darth Vader with an asthma inhaler. A large, hairy car-fixing friend. A Yoda-like professor. Finally, there's his muse, Marion, who leads the student rebellion, wears her hair in buns, and, in a twist ending, turns out to be Lucas's sister. The short launched Nussbaum's directional career after Steven Spielberg got hold of a copy and sent it to Lucas, who sent Nussbaum an approving letter commending him for doing his research. He'd spotted a line from American Graffiti. There's a kind of mutual love affair between Lucas and spoofs that feature him as a character. He is never the target. He is the sage one does not cross. A 2007 short called Pitching Lucas stars a Lucas lookalike who is offered three Star Wars live-action TV show ideas by sleazy Hollywood executives. Variations on $6 Million Man, Chips, and Charlie's Angels. Lucas dispatches each executive to a variety of grisly endings. And that, he concludes, is why I always write my own scripts. Pitching Lucas won the George Lucas Select stamp of approval from the creator himself, as did the 2004 short Escape from Tatooine, which ends with Boba Fett crash landing on an alternate Earth where Lucas has been enshrined in a giant statue at the Lincoln Memorial. It was surprisingly late in the day, the mid-2000s, before parodists started to explore the possibilities of putting Darth Vader in mundane situations. Perhaps they were taking the lead of Lucas, who had by then fleshed out all of Vader's backstory. Perhaps they were simply waiting for the rise of YouTube. In 2007, users of the nascent online video service were treated to Chad Vader, Day Shift Manager, in which a Vader-like character, said to be the Dark Lord's brother, has to manage recalcitrant employees at a very earthbound supermarket. The pilot episode was seen 12 million times. The show went on for 38 episodes, split into four seasons. British comedian Eddie Izzard imagined Darth Vader attempting to navigate the Death Star canteen, a stop-motion version of the Izzard skit starring Lego Star Wars figures, now has 21 million views on YouTube. YouTube also offers some wonderfully surreal Dadaist cut-ups of the source material itself. The Vader Sessions, which has more than 5 million views, took every one of Vader's scenes in the original Star Wars, which amounted to a mere 10 minutes, and dubbed in James Earl Jones' quotes from other movies, modulated Vader style. "I know you have been inconvenienced, and I am prepared to compensate you," Vader now says to the dead rebel troops in the corridor of the Tantive IV, in a line from Coming to America. "Shall we say $1 million American? Very well, then, $2 million. There was, it soon became clear, comedy gold in treating Vader, a Jedi-killing, child-murdering, daughter-torturing, son-amputating man-machine, as a fragile, everyday kind of fellow. He's like the most evil guy in the galaxy, but there's a part of you that wants to know what that feels like, says Jack Sullivan, the 32-year-old Boston-based asset manager who runs At Depressed Darth, one of Twitter's most popular Star Wars parody accounts. Sullivan started the account in 2010 to promote a YouTube short he was planning to make of Vader walking around Boston begging for spare change. The short never got made, but the account gained more than 500,000 followers thanks to a steady diet of sad Vader jokes and Star Wars puns. Sullivan is already making a respectable $5,000 a month from selling ads on his Depressed Darth website and is considering retiring from the financial industry to go into full-time tweeting. Perhaps the most telling Vader spoof, for an aging generation of parents who'd grown up on Star Wars, is Jeffrey Brown's New York Times best-selling volumes Darth Vader and Son, 2012, and Vader's Little Princess, 2013. This was Vader at his most mundane, facing the challenges of single parenthood with Luke and Leia, respectively, in a series of heartwarming cartoons. Every modern mom or dad who'd identified with Luke or Leia in the 1970s, only to grow up and find themselves the Vaders of their households, could relate. When everyone wants in on the joke, and the source material is this widely recognized, what you get is endless iterations of everything the franchise could possibly be. The first Star Wars spoof to win a primetime Emmy, the epic Star Wars Uncut, could not have been more collaborative. The brainchild of 26-year-old web developer Casey Pugh, Star Wars Uncut chopped the original movie into 473 segments lasting 15 seconds each, and then let fans sign up online to reshoot each segment in their own way, each with the no-budget earnestness of Hardware Wars, and each given roughly the same amount of time to shoot it, 30 days. It was so heavily oversubscribed that Pugh added an extra step, letting fans vote on the best versions of each segment. Stitch them together, and you get 2 hours of non-stop, gut-busting hilarity, humor born of the shock of recognition. It's basically the same movie, as well as the gleefully earnest recreations by delightful amateurs. I was particularly amused to discover a couple of my friends had made it into the movie. The husband played Han Solo. The wife, 8 months pregnant, played Jabba the Hutt. So there are certain common elements in this litany of Star Wars spoofs. They either add to the myth in some subtle, subversive way, or they lovingly replicate it. They add a layer of something else in pop culture, or put Star Wars concepts in incongruous, mundane situations. But the idea of Star Wars is always respected. The franchise's reality is unsullied. If anything, it is boosted by the flattery. Star Wars, it turns out, is a broad church able to absorb all laughter. Is any comedian truly capable of getting under the skin of Star Wars, skewering it more than wallowing in a version of it? There have been a few attempts. In 2007, a couple of friends with animated TV shows, Seth MacFarlane, creator of Family Guy, and Seth Green, co-creator of Cartoon Network's Robot Chicken, began to use their respective platforms to produce some epic Star Wars meta next-level spoofs. It's fair to say Green had the idea first, as his character, Chris, complains on the Family Guy spoof Blue Harvest, named for the undercover title for Return of the Jedi. It's also fair to say, as MacFarlane's character shoots back, that Family Guy has the larger viewership. Blue Harvest, which got the greatest audience share of any Family Guy episode to date, goes the route of layering its Griffin family humor over a Star Wars animated homage. It does have a few moments of true satire, such as the opening crawl, which marvelously manages to both spoil and belittle the entire classic trilogy. It is a time of civil war and renegade paragraphs floating through space. There's cool space battles, and the bad guy is the good guy's dad, but you don't find that out till the next episode. And the hot chick is really the sister of the good guy, but they don't know it, and they kiss, which is kind of messed up. I mean, what if they had done it instead of just kissed? After that, there is the occasional joke aimed squarely at the holes in Star Wars logic, such as the laser operators on the Star Destroyer who let R2-D2 and C-3PO's escape pod go because there were no life forms on board. Hold your fire? What, are we paying by the laser now? But MacFarlane seems to lose interest in attacking the franchise at that point, falling back on his usual winning blend of toilet humor and pop culture callbacks. His Star Wars references, for most of the feature-length episode, consist of lovingly recreated, animated homages to iconic special effects scenes from the movie, such as the Millennium Falcon taking off from Mos Eisley. One of the most irreverent popular satirists of our age, it turned out, could little more attack the franchise than throw a chair through a stained glass window. For the Blue Harvest DVD release, MacFarlane traveled to Skywalker Ranch and conducted an unusually fawning interview with Lucas. Green's stop-motion puppet show Robot Chicken kept its satirical knives out for the franchise itself far longer than MacFarlane did, even though its spoof was supposed to be a one-off sketch. In The Emperor's Phone Call, 3 million YouTube views, Emperor Palpatine is informed of the destruction of the Death Star. There it is again, the most humorous object in the universe, via collect call from Vader. The conversation that follows skewers both Star Wars and Return of the Jedi. "I'm sorry, I thought my Dark Lord of the Sith could protect a small thermal exhaust port that was only 2 meters wide. That thing wasn't even fully paid off yet," yells the Emperor, voiced by McFarlane. "Oh, just rebuild it? That'd be a real fucking original." It was as if Mad had finally gone far enough for Charlie Lippincott. To Lucasfilm's great surprise, Lucas, encouraged by his son Jet to watch the show, adored the Robot Chicken parody. The creator brought Green and his co-writer, Matthew Seinreich, to Skywalker Ranch. The pair got Lucas to not only agree to 2 full-length Robot Chicken Star Wars episodes, but to participate as voice talent, his first professional acting role. "I don't know what I was thinking," said Lucas, as his doll reclined on a couch in a therapist's office, on his decision to let Robot Chicken do a special. But Lucas's participation didn't preclude the sketches from pointing out more previously unseen flaws in the movies. Take the moment Luke sits down in the Millennium Falcon after escaping the Death Star, and Leia puts a blanket over his shoulders as he mourns Obi-Wan Kenobi. "I can't believe he's gone," says Luke. Instead of sympathy, the Robot Chicken version of Leia offers this. "Oh, did the 80-year-old man you met yesterday just die? Sorry if I didn't notice. I was just busy thinking about my entire family and the other 2 billion people from Alderaan who were just vaporized into dust about 3 hours ago." Leia's voice was provided by Carrie Fisher, who read it like she'd wanted to say that for a long time. No matter how edgy the pair got, it didn't seem to matter. Green and Seinreich soon found themselves the court jesters of Lucasfilm Animation. They collaborated on a new project, which they and Lucas announced to fans at Lucasfilm's Celebration Convention in 2011, called Star Wars Detours, aimed at more of a family audience. 6 trailers were released online. Fans didn't take to it. "It seems the show is really just Robot Chicken neutered," sighed Badass Digest, one of the few news sites to cover it. After Disney bought Lucasfilm, Detours was put aside. Those 6 trailers were taken down from YouTube. Nearly 40 episodes had been completed, but at time of writing remained unseen. Said Green, "We didn't think it made any sense, in anticipation of these new movies coming out, to spend the next 3 years with an animated sitcom as kids' first introduction to the Star Wars universe. Especially not if the humor of that sitcom was to fall flat with the Star Wars-loving adults who would invariably watch it." That's the danger with Star Wars spoofing. You're always just one step away from widespread derision if you say something jarring, or if you don't quite catch the elusive, effervescent giddiness of the movies. Obama may be the Star Wars president, but even he messed up a month after the Death Star petition response, mangling his franchises in a later speech, joking that he wasn't going to somehow do a Jedi mind meld on Congress. Millions of Star Wars geeks and Trekkers suddenly cried out in anguish. The president had conflated Jedi mind trick with Vulcan mind meld. Which brings us to the coda to the whole Centives affair. In December 2012, Sean Goodwin tried another whimsical Death Star post suggested by a commenter. How long would it take to mop all the floors on the Death Star? Sean did the math on the floor space. 359.2 million square kilometers, roughly the area of the Earth, and figured it would take 11.4 million years worth of hours to mop it all. To get the job done in a year would take 48 million workers. If they all took minimum wage, the mopping would cost $723 billion a year. The article went nowhere. No one cared about mopping the Death Star. Why had it failed while its predecessor succeeded? Suspension of disbelief, suggested Anjan. People could just about imagine building a Death Star, but not keeping it clean. They assumed robots would do it. Their brush with intergalactic greatness was over. Sean and Anjan handed the keys to the Centives blog over to a new generation. Anjan became a management consultant in New York, and Sean taught English in Bangkok. They fondly remember the days when their ridiculously impossible idea went all the way to the White House, but they don't really claim too much credit. "We were inspired by the Death Star because it's the Death Star," Anjan said. What really sparked it all was the fact that Star Wars made a difficult concept seem real. 10. Star Wars has a posse. By December 1975, the month the Fox board met to decide the fate of Star Wars, George Lucas had all his difficult concepts in place. He was wrapping up the fourth draft and knew how most of the pieces would fit together. He had explained the Force in 28 words. The stormtroopers now carried blasters, not lightsabers, though the lightsaber-carrying tubes on the back of their costumes would last into the movie, like a vestigial tail. The Death Star came into focus, no longer eclipsed by long scenes on Alderaan. The flow of blood onto the page was ebbing, and Lucas was even starting to enjoy himself. "I've loosened up a bit," he confessed to Charlie Lippincott. "It's more fun to have other people make suggestions, so you don't have to do all the work." Loosened up, of course, is a relative term. 1976 would see Lucas drive himself harder than ever, into sickness, into the hospital. He would have trouble delegating simple tasks, such as which lights to turn on or off during a given shot, leading to friction with his more experienced British crew. But at the same time, Lucas had overcome his instinct to go it alone. He would solicit more advice than ever before, more than with THX, co-written with Walter Murch, or American Graffiti, co-written with Hike and Katz. This was a big universe, and he was still building it, some of it from spare parts. There was a lot of room for other craftspeople, so long as Lucas trusted their competence. Star Wars, then, was no longer just a script written in agonizing isolation on a door desk. As 1976 dawned, Lucas found himself the ringleader in a circus of genius, the head of one of those once-in-a-generation teams of fiery young Turks eager to prove themselves. As seems appropriate, given the influence it drew from Westerns, Star Wars had a posse. And it was more vital in producing the look, feel, and content of the film than history, seeking a single creator, has given it credit for. Lucas himself understood the power of teamwork and appreciated the contributions of any collaborators already in his inner circle. "The creator," said Ralph McQuarrie, "was very happy if you came up with ideas that were very different." McQuarrie, who died in 2012, remains the most beloved and most crucial member of the Star Wars posse. His production paintings pushed the wavering Fox board into Lucas's camp in December 1975. "McQuarrie sold it, needless to say," said Lippincott, who put together that crucial presentation. Without McQuarrie, Lucas might never have gotten the budget he needed to make his little space thing. But the artist had many more contributions to the franchise. We've already seen how McQuarrie helped create the mechanized version of Vader and the heartbreakingly human droids. He also casually offered a floating block orb from an animated film he'd been working on. This became the robot that tortures Princess Leia. McQuarrie's sketches and paintings would inform the look of every character and every set, from the Jawa droid market to the Death Star to the fourth moon of Yavin, where Lucas wanted the rebel ships to be outside in the jungle. "But they're in hiding," McQuarrie pointed out. "They should have their ships squirreled away somewhere. How about inside a temple?" Like Lucas, McQuarrie started to think up backstory that would never make it onto the screen. He was fond of dozing off on a comfortable couch, allowing ideas to rise unbidden, like bubbles in champagne, he said. In one such liminal moment, he saw the rebel ships on Yavin 4 taking refuge in ancient temples with a special kind of stone that counteracted gravity, allowing the fighters to move in and out of the hangar more easily. McQuarrie, self-effacing to the end, would argue that any decent artist could have gotten Star Wars past the Fox board. Other artists disagree. "If I had 100 people working for me, none would come up with what Ralph imagined," says Paul Bateman, a concept artist who collaborated with McQuarrie in his later years. Bateman helps take care of McQuarrie's extensive archive. "Artistically, Star Wars is Ralph's vision, even when he felt he was just interpreting the words. Star Wars wasn't only Lucas and Macquarie's baby, of course. Not by a long shot. There was producer Gary Kurtz, the posse's longest-serving member. Kurtz fell out with Lucasfilm after he allowed Empire Strikes Back to go massively over budget, as we'll see, which may explain why the company's official history tends to underplay his contribution. But it seems fair to say that Kurtz was the kind of sounding board Lucas needed at this stage in his career. The kind that talked back. For example, Kurtz studied comparative religion in college with a particular interest in Buddhism, Hinduism, and Native American religions. He was earnestly unhappy about the way the Force was treated in those early drafts, the way it seemed to get all its energy from the Kyber crystal. He also wasn't a fan of the Bogun and Ashla concepts that lingered on, even into the third draft. He showed Lucas a lot of his college textbooks. There was plenty of time, as the years dragged on, for director and producer to chew this sort of thing over. We did have long discussions about various religious philosophies and how people related to them and how we could simplify it, Kurtz remembers. Whether Lucas was on the path already with his Golden Bough studies, or whether Kurtz nudged him in the right direction in some late-night talk about karma, prana, and the universal energy of the Navajo, is a question that will likely never be resolved. What is black and white? If Star Wars had won the Best Picture Academy Award it was nominated for, it would have been Kurtz alone bounding onto the stage to accept it, and with good reason. He took charge of the constant, penny-pinching budget revisions required by Fox. He scouted for the best combination of experienced workers and low-cost sound stages, and chose Elstree Film Studios, hidden in the drab wasteland of a suburb called Boreham Wood, just outside of London. He made some unusual but brilliant hires, including John Mallow, an expert in military uniforms and historical dramas, who would win an Academy Award for his costume design in Star Wars. Kurtz also hired Ben Burtt as sound designer, on the recommendation of Walter Murch. Burtt would go on to become one of the most significant and long-lasting members of the Star Wars posse. He's still in it today. Again, it was the Macquarie paintings that sold it to him. Immediately, I could see this was the kind of movie I'd tried to make as a kid, said Burtt, an amateur camera enthusiast. Back then, Burtt was the epitome of the young and hungry Lucas employee, fresh out of school, whip-smart, but not too proud to be a gopher. He ran Carrie Fisher to hairstyle test appointments. He went to the zoo and asked for a bear to be starved for a day, then have a bowl of milk and bread wafted under its nose so he could gain enough anguished hunger to make the roar that became, with the judicious application of a sea lion, the sound of a Wookiee. Bears in zoos are too content, explains Burtt. Still, Burtt set his expectations really low, as did much of the posse. It wasn't humility so much as a sign of the times, of how ridiculous it was to think that any kind of space movie could go mainstream. He thought it might do well for a couple of weeks. The best thing I could imagine, said Burtt, was that we would get to have a table at next year's Star Trek convention. As crucial as the behind-the-scenes posse was, the movie would have gone nowhere without the right on-screen posse. That meant getting the casting just right, which was especially difficult considering Lucas was mostly looking for unknown actors to populate his galaxy. Star Wars boasted a trio of talented casting directors, Vic Ramos, Irene Lamb, and Diane Crittenden. But the most influential voice in casting the lead actors turned out to belong to a guy who wasn't on the books at all. Fred Roos had assembled the unparalleled ensemble of The Godfather for Coppola and American Graffiti for Lucas. He had since gone on to produce Coppola's movies The Godfather Part II and The Conversation. For Star Wars, George just asked me to come along and consult, Roos recalls. I was never hired, so to speak. I was just family. Roos's first contribution was to push for a friend of his, the teenage daughter of Hollywood icon Debbie Reynolds and her long-ago ex-husband, Eddie Fisher, for the role of Princess Leia. Roos had hung out with Carrie Fisher on a number of occasions and found her to be charming and sexy with a quick wit and a nascent writing talent. Fisher did herself no favors by missing the first casting call. She was enrolled in the Central School of Speech and Drama in London at the time and didn't think it worth skipping class for. But Roos kept bringing her name up with Lucas, who was leaning toward choosing actress Terry Nunn for the role. Lucas finally met Fisher when she was back in L.A. over the Christmas break, on December 30, 1975. He asked her to read the speech that Leia gives in hologram form to R2-D2. At that point, the speech was extremely wordy. Many actresses had been defeated by it, but Fisher had just been schooled in elocution. She had gained a mild British accent and a propensity for tongue twisters. Her favorite was, and remains, "I want a proper cup of coffee from a proper copper coffee pot. If I can't have a proper cup of coffee from a proper copper coffee pot, I'll have a cup of tea." She nailed the speech. Roos's second contribution to Star Wars, albeit a more unintentional one, was to bring in Harrison Ford, whom he had hired for that bit role back on American Graffiti. Lucas was adamant that no one who had appeared in American Graffiti would also appear in Star Wars. He had a stubborn notion that it would distract the audience. But after Roos brought Ford in to do some carpentry around the American Zoetrope office in L.A., where casting meetings were held, Lucas decided to have Ford read the role of Han Solo opposite a string of potential Princess Leias and Luke Starkillers. All other versions of this story have credited Roos with a clever piece of manipulation in throwing Ford into Lucas's path like that. "It's a nice story," Roos says, before reluctantly admitting that wasn't his intention. The Zoetrope office just happened to need a new door, and he knew a carpenter. "Harrison had done a lot of carpentry for me. He needed money. He had kids. He wasn't a big movie star yet," Roos says. The day he was doing it, George happened to be there. It was serendipitous. Credit that missing door, then, for one of the great scoundrels of cinematic history. As for Luke Starkiller, Lucas liked a TV actor called Will Seltzer. He had earlier dismissed a young soap opera actor known for his role in General Hospital, Mark Hamill. But the casting director insisted that Lucas see Hamill again, and brought him in on December 30, the same day Carrie Fisher finally showed up. Like Fisher, Hamill had memorized one of the most wordy pieces of dialogue his character had in the third draft. Like Fisher, he nailed it. Still, the casting wasn't a sure thing. Lucas ended up with two slates of actors for the three main roles: Ford, Hamill, and Fisher on one hand, Christopher Walken, Will Seltzer, and Terry Nunn on the other. The first slate was chosen simply because they were available and willing to shoot in London, and in Hamill's case, Tunisia, that March. All accepted the fee Lucas offered them, $1,000 a week. Ford demanded a change in his contract. He wasn't interested in the sequels George kept talking about and didn't want to be obligated to appear in them. It would be reasonable to assume they were just going to be carbon copies of the original. Fox was pushing for at least one big name in the cast. Lucas reportedly made overtures to Toshirô Mifune, one of the most famous actors in Japan and a star of Kurosawa movies. He had played the fearsome samurai general in Hidden Fortress and a tempestuous wannabe knight in Seven Samurai. Lucas offered Mifune the role of Obi-Wan Kenobi, according to Mifune's daughter Mika. Later, she claimed her father was also offered Darth Vader. In any case, it came to naught. Alec Guinness just happened to be in L.A. playing a butler in a satirical movie, Murder by Death, at the end of 1975. The venerable British actor was a legend of Ealing comedies, as well as weightier roles, such as his Oscar-winning, obsessive Lieutenant Colonel Nicholson in Bridge Over the River Kwai, a movie Lucas had seen and loved as a kid. Lucas and Kurtz made overtures, sending a screenplay to Guinness's hotel. Guinness's first reaction wasn't encouraging. "Good God, it's science fiction. Why are they offering me this?" The dialogue was pretty ropey, he wrote. But he did agree to meet Lucas for dinner before he left town, encouraged by the fact that his director on Murder by Death respected Lucas's works so far. "There's a real filmmaker." In his diary, Guinness remembered a small, neat-faced young man with poorish teeth, glasses, and not much sense of humor. There wasn't much of a connection. The conversation was divided culturally by 8,000 miles and 30 years. Still, Guinness liked Lucas's description of Kenobi as Gandalf-like, which gave him something to work with. And he could get on with Lucas, Guinness thought, if I can get past his intensity. In January, Lucas and Kurtz offered Guinness an intense sum to appear in the film. $150,000, as much as Lucas was getting paid to write and direct it. Guinness would also get 2% of Kurtz's profit points. The script was a little silly, and the points probably wouldn't mean anything, Guinness reasoned, but the salary would at least allow him to live in the style to which he was accustomed, if his latest West End play was a flop. As 1976 dawned, Lucas rushed up and down the California coast, trying to take care of a laundry list of items before heading to London to begin filming. Dykstra's special effects operation in Van Nuys was running far behind schedule, and Lucas got to know the 9 a.m. Monday Pacific Southwest Air, PSA, jet from SFO to LAX very well, with its large painted smile underneath the nose. He spent more than $8,200 on plane tickets and rental cars, which Fox still hadn't agreed to cover. On a typical day in L.A., he would get up at 3 a.m. to do 25 storyboards, finish them in time for a 9 a.m. casting meeting, and then go to ILM until 9 p.m. That brutal schedule didn't factor in Lucas's obsessive revisions to the fourth draft of the script. A writer-director ends up working 20 hours a day, he complained to Lippincott. It was only a slight exaggeration. Some of those working hours were enough to make Lucas miss the agony of writing. At ILM, Lucas and Dykstra were already butting heads over how long it was taking to build the revolutionary camera system, the Dykstraflex. Despite its name, the Dykstraflex was a group effort between all the artist engineers at ILM. It was a Frankenstein's monster of old VistaVision cameras hooked up to the spaghetti wires of integrated computer circuits. In theory, and there were an awful lot of theories involved in the Dykstraflex, you could program it to move through 7 axes of motion. In other words, it should be able to swoop up, around, over, and under one spaceship model, giving the model the illusion of perfect movement. And because you could simply repeat the same program for the next ship when you splice them together, you could make it look like one was following the other. Assembly of the Dykstraflex had put the nascent ILM far behind schedule, but Dykstra was proving hard to motivate. Lucas's friends heard complaints that ILM under Dykstra and his young charges had become a hippie commune, although the special effects wunderkind preferred the term country club. Weed was smoked freely. These young geniuses, most in their early 20s, were often stoned out of their gourds. A tiny cold tub was set up outside to escape the heat of the warehouse. At night, they would blast old spaceship prototypes into the sky and watch the occasional porno. Still, there was reason to tolerate all this. If the Dykstraflex worked, it could cut the cost of special effects in half. ILM's artists were proud of their spaceship models, but there was already a major problem with one of them. Local stations across the United States had started screening Space 1999, a science fiction TV show imported from the UK in late 1975. It was set on the moon, which is knocked out of orbit and into interstellar space by a nuclear explosion. Space 1999 had been aimed at the U.S. market with American actors and a hefty $3 million special effects budget for the first season. It was bad enough that the characters mentioned a mysterious force that was supposedly guiding the moon's journey or talked about the problems of going to the dark side of the moon. Worse, that the moon base's major ship, the Eagle, looked a lot like Han Solo's long, sleek pirate vessel, which ILM model makers had just completed, and which Lucas had just named in the fourth draft, the Millennium Falcon. Eagle. Falcon. Lucas was going to look like a plagiarist. So ILM had to come up with a bold and costly new design. And the answer to the question of who gets the credit for it is as fuzzy as the Falcon's co-pilot. The original Falcon had cost $25,000, a third of the whole model budget. It was reused as the Rebel ship at the beginning of the movie, the Tantive IV. The official Lucasfilm account has Lucas coming up with the concept on a plane, basing it on a hamburger. But Joe Johnston, who'd painted the first Falcon and was to become one of the franchise's most important visionaries, remembers Lucas's only instruction as, "Think of a flying saucer." Johnston thought that too cheesy in 1950s and added the other essential elements of sticking the old ship's cockpit to one side and adding those large pincers at the front. Still a third story I heard from a Lucasfilm veteran is that Lucas had a eureka moment in the ILM cafeteria. Peeling the bun from his burger, Lucas ate a lot of burgers in those days, he stuck an olive on one side and made the tines of a fork represent the front. That sounds like a classic Lucas moment. Lightly, unself-consciously building something unusual out of whatever was to hand. Sketching the big picture and leaving it to others to work out the details. "Look around you," Lucas once told Howard Kazanjian, his old USC friend whom he tried to bring into the Star Wars posse, but who had too many other movie commitments at the time. "Look around you. Ideas are everywhere." Ideas, props, and happy accidents were everywhere in London, too. While Lucas was readying his California crew, their counterparts in England were laying vital groundwork for the deliberately grimy, scuffed-up props and sets that were soon to take shape at Elstree. Production designer John Barry had his team scouring junkyards and flea markets for washers, pipes, parts of cameras, parts of guns. It was all in the best British tradition, as science fiction shows in the United Kingdom did not normally have space 1999 budgets. Prop masters had to get creative. Doctor Who had literally begun in a London junkyard 13 years earlier. That was fine with Lucas, who was looking for a kitbashing aesthetic himself. "I'm trying to make props that don't stand out," he told Lippincott. "I'm working very hard to keep everything non-symmetrical. I want it to look like one thing came from one part of the galaxy and another from another." The used universe. It was the same concept Lucas had for THX. This time, it came with non-symmetrical clothing, not blinding white uniforms. John Mallow made do on a budget of $90,000, less than the cost of a single set. In his sketchbook, amidst phone numbers and to-do lists, and notes on how much he'd spent parking, you can see Mallow's naive early images slowly transform into the characters we know today. Darth Vader's costume, perhaps the most infamous villain's outfit in all of cinema, cost Mallow a mere $1,100 to put together, mostly out of motorcycle leathers. Luke's costume cost twice that. Mallow assembled it out of a pair of white jeans, boots, and a Japanese-style robe. The first shoot of the film took place in the Tunisian desert with the critical, and at times unexpected, gear provided by Barry and Mallow's teams. When Kurtz had to charter a Lockheed Hercules to fly some forgotten equipment from London to Tunisia, spending $22,000 to move $5,000 worth of essential gear, it just so happened that there was space on the plane for a skeleton the British crew had uncovered. A Diplodocus from the Disney movie One of Our Dinosaurs is Missing, shot at Elstree a couple of years earlier. Up went the cry, "Just throw it on the plane!" That became the skeleton we see when 3PO and R2 crash land on the desert planet. In later years, it was named the Crate Dragon, and, like many other things in the Star Wars universe, given a weighty backstory by someone other than George Lucas. The adversity of that Tunisia shoot would become legendary. A truck carrying robots caught fire. A freak thunderstorm, the first in that location in 50 years, devastated the set. The remote control R2-D2 wouldn't move the way it was designed to. Kenny Baker, the diminutive actor inside one version of the trash can droid, kept falling over. Anthony Daniels, encased in C-3PO for the first time, managed to rip the fiberglass costume at the leg, soaking the shards in decidedly undroid-like blood. Lucas was compromising left and right to get the shoot done. Still, even as they shot, he kept tinkering with the fourth draft, on a French typewriter where the keys were all wrong. Here he had his last major revelation about the script, which had to do with the Death Star. Here's the problem as it stood. The Dirty Half-Dozen, as Lucas called them, Luke, Han, Obi-Wan, two droids, and a Wookiee, arrive in the Millennium Falcon. The Dirty Half-Dozen, plus one princess, leave in the Falcon. If they all slipped in and out unchallenged, what threat was this mighty battle station? There needed to be some sacrifice. Something to make clear that the Death Star was a danger to be reckoned with. Marcia Lucas, a reluctant part of the Star Wars posse from the very beginning, had two suggestions. The first was to kill 3PO, which Lucas simply couldn't bring himself to do. Then she suggested sacrificing another character, one who had nothing to do after the Death Star but utters a few sage statements during the final dogfight. In retrospect, it's obvious. Obi-Wan Kenobi must die during his lightsaber battle with Darth Vader. The venerable Sir Alec and Lady Marula Guinness had only just arrived in Tunisia. A party was arranged for his birthday. He was getting into the used universe spirit. Before his first scene, the great actor rolled around in his costume on the desert floor. Having coaxed the famous man this far, Lucas was loath to cut him out so quickly. He would wait till they got back to London to make the final decision. In the meantime, Lucas added a couple more changes to the revised script. First, he wanted to find a new name for the planet Tunisia was supposed to represent. For one thing, Star Trek fans might point out that the name, Yutapau, sounded a little too much like T'Pau, a famous female Vulcan character. For another, Lucas had developed a useful habit of saying the names he was writing aloud. If he ever faltered on the pronunciation, he went looking for alternatives. Luckily, there was a nearby city in Tunisia Lucas liked the sound of. The Tunisians transliterated from the Arabic most commonly as Tatawin, spelled T-A-T-A-O-U-I-N-E. Lucas decided to spell it T-A-T-O-O-I-N-E. Second, Lucas needed to find a new name for the character played by Mark Hamill, the only leading American actor who had come to Tunisia for the shoot. Lucas was sick of people asking him if Luke Starkiller had anything to do with cult murderer Charles Manson, sometimes known as the Starkiller. This conflation of the two meanings for star would continue to dog Lucas. Fox's marketing department complained that people would assume the Star Wars was a movie about conflict between Hollywood luminaries. The studio's market research, which consisted of posing 20 questions to passers-by in a mall, also concluded that people would confuse the title with Star Trek, and, most urgently, the majority of respondents, fatigued by Vietnam, simply didn't care to see any more films with war in the title. Lucas and Kurtz postponed conflict over the name by removing the definite article and asking Fox executives to come up with alternate names for the film. They failed to do so because there weren't a lot of people there who were that interested, one way or the other, says Kurtz. As far as Lucas was concerned, pre-Tunisia, the full title of the movie was The Adventures of Luke Starkiller as taken from the Journal of the Wills, Saga 1, Star Wars. For the name of Luke's character, at least, Lucas was prepared to compromise. He dragged up his second choice name from the first draft. Thus, Luke Skywalker re-entered the Star Wars universe, this time as a young hero, and the Starkiller name was put on ice. Until 2008, that is, when Starkiller became the name of Darth Vader's apprentice in the video game Force Unleashed. Luckily, no dialogue would have to be reshot. Luke's full name isn't mentioned in the script until he announces it to Leia on the Death Star, a scene that would be shot back in London. Luke's inspiration, meanwhile, had driven himself into the ground. Lucas described himself as depressed and desperately unhappy. He shunned the Tunisia rap party in favor of sleep. Worst days awaited him in London. In April 2013, speaking at Windsor Castle before the Queen and an audience of British film luminaries, Lucas would put a nostalgic gloss on his early trips to London. "I've been coming here since 1975," he says. "So for me, this is like a second home." To drive home the point, he added a curious use of the royal we. "The White House, the government there, doesn't support the film industry the way we do in Britain." But in 1976, During one of the hottest summers on record, Lucas's experience of Britain, and especially its film industry, was ghastly. The crew was openly hostile to the crazy American and his children's film. 80% of the crew of the